What is an ecosystem-based strategy? How and why will it replace the traditional firm-based view of business strategy? Entrepreneur, business consultant, and author Ralph Wellborn is here to tell us.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast. Entrepreneurs are economic heroes. They improve others' lives with preferred products and services, innovation, and value. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one by building a beautiful business. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. We are traditionally directed by strategists to build a business strategy on the foundation of a firm. Start a firm, grow a firm, build a portfolio of brands and services within a firm, deliver value from a firm to the customer, and so on. But in Economics for Business, the platform for the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast and a whole raft of additional services we're developing, we ask a different set of questions based on the insights of Austrian economics. Austrian economics asks, why do firms even exist? And we take a systems view, and we deduce that firms are part of a larger economic system to deliver value to customers. Think of a B2B customer. Let's say it's a construction company. It's embedded in a system that includes suppliers of materials, suppliers of specialist labor and skills, delivery companies, architects, lawyers, customers who need buildings or offices, government planners, and many, many more. Or think of a consumer. To enjoy family dinners every day, the consumer embeds themselves in a system of food and beverage manufacturers, packaging suppliers, farmers, retailers, recipe ideas, cutlery and placeware manufacturers, condiment suppliers, and many more. To our guest today, Ralph Wellborn, these are orchestrated business ecosystems. They're dynamic, shifting, evolving entities. Customer value is both created and destroyed within these entities. For example, when consumer preferences change from packaged, preserved food to fresh, organic food, the value that used to come from the convenience of low-priced packaged food is destroyed. A new value is created on a different vector of freshness and authenticity and freedom from preservatives. And the answer to the Austrian question of why do firms exist? It's to capture this new and changing value by fitting in and contributing to the changing, shifting ecosystem. Fitting in because the customer is not going to change their entire ecosystem for making family dinners possible. They just want to change one area or aspect of it. And contributing because the firm must bring something new and better so that the system now facilitates more value for the customer than it did before. Fitting in and contributing to the system is the pathway to the firm facilitating value for the customer. That's a systems-based view. For Ralph Wellborn, it implies the need to adopt an ecosystem-based view of business strategy, replacing the traditional firm-based view. Let's listen. For our context, Ralph has been a business consultant and strategist for 25 years, including leading IBM's strategy and transformation business in multiple regions, and a senior vice president at KPMG Consulting. He now runs his own consulting company, Clear Prism, which implements many of the insights, processes, and models that Ralph has shared with the world in his book, Topple: The End of the Firm-Based Strategy and the Rise of New Models for Explosive Growth. Ralph, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's great. It's very kind of you to join us. And we've got a super interesting topic today, which is we always think at Economics for Entrepreneurs as business being conducted in a firm. So entrepreneurs create firms, LLCs are firms, C-Corps are firms, S-Corps are firms, partnerships are firms, startups are firms. Entrepreneurs are the energy behind the production of value, and the locus of the production is the firm. And then we open your new book, which is called Topple, and we find that you say the new competitive landscape will be shaped less by firm-specific strategies and more by new business models powered by ecosystem-centric strategies. So let's have you start off by explaining ecosystems, what they are and how you see them.
Yeah, that's quite a mouthful, isn't it? The way I look at it, an ecosystem is the orchestration of capabilities to deliver value. Now, today, ecosystem means a lot of things to a lot of people. It's pretty much a hot topic, and it tends to mean, give me a bunch of partners, right? So Microsoft has a big bunch of ecosystem partners, SAP and so on, have a bunch of ecosystem partners. I look at it a little bit differently. It's the orchestration of capabilities from different firms mobilized to deliver a certain type of value. Do you want me to give you an example?
Yes, please.
Probably help. So I had the absolute privilege in my past to work in Africa, in East and West Africa. And there was a particular problem, a use case. And we were able to apply, in essence, an A-B test to it. One of our clients packed in the same use case, and I'll explain the use case. Was Africa's fastest growing bank. So it's a firm. And they said, hey, here's an opportunity for us. Let's figure out how we tackle this problem. And yet with an entrepreneur, I said, well, let's approach this a different way. So here's the use case. The use case was I'm the head of a household. It's Tuesday and I run out of money and I can't buy food for my family until Friday. What do you do? So that's the use case. And so you had one of Africa's fastest growing banks who said, well, it's pretty straightforward. What you do is you look at the value chain, all the activities that I as a bank deliver, and I cut the cost on each of those steps and I package it together and deliver it as a micro loan. And so that is one approach, a very, very typical firm-centric approach around which to do that. And we did it. And at the end of 4 months, they were delivering approximately 1,500 of these loans a week. Not bad. The other approach with the entrepreneur was we said, well, look, what's the problem we're solving? The problem was this issue. I need to get food in order to pay for my family. The approach we took was, well, what are the key capabilities you need around which to do that? Well, one thing, Hunter, you need is you need a mechanism of exchange in order to buy food. Right? I mean, clearly. So what do you do though, honey? Let me ask you, what do you do if you don't have money in order to buy food? The capability is I need a mechanism by which to acquire food for my family. If you don't have money, what else is there?
Well, we would say here in the West, credit.
Yes, but credit is still dependent upon you having a certain amount of cash in your bank around which that you could pay back that debt.
Or barter?
Barter is a possibility. Problem with barter is it doesn't scale. So let me give you a hint. In Africa, there are 1.2 mobile phones per person.
So you create it digitally?
Well, almost minutes, mobile minutes. Minutes are a mechanism of exchange. It's not money, right? But it is a mechanism of exchange. Now, who delivers minutes? Phone companies. So here I'm an entrepreneur. I recognize that one of the core capabilities I need to solve this problem is a mode of exchange that is not dollars, or it's not a type of currency. I mean, it is a type of currency, but it's not your typical unit of currency. It's mobile minutes. Who owns it? Telcos. What does that mean? I need to go establish a partnership with large telco carriers in order to leverage that capability into my solution. Similarly, one of the other capabilities you need to have is you need to know where you can go buy food. Well, how are you going to get insight into that? Well, you're going to go figure out what stores will allow you to exchange goods with mobile minutes. And that requires you establishing a partnership with other people who provide that capability. In this case, it happened to be Tiger Brand, which is Africa's largest supply chain network. So the point is, what this entrepreneur did, he said, what are the key capabilities that I need? And then let me go establish partnerships with these different entities out there and orchestrate these different capabilities in service of tackling that problem. I, entrepreneur, don't need to own all those things because, again, mobile minutes is driven by Safaricom or a telco. But I do need to have access to it. I do need to orchestrate and have access to that information whereby I can put it in service to what it is that I'm delivering. Well, then you say, well, hold on. What on earth is the incentive for a telco to do that? And here's where it starts to get really interesting. Number one, telco faced a key problem. A key problem they all face is They don't make a lot of money on voice. They make a lot of money on data, but they don't own the data pipes. The data pipes are owned by someone else. So if you can deliver value to them, to the telco, whereby you could push more data through their pipes, you can lower, you can close what's known as the Jaws chart between revenue between a voice and data. And of course, the telco is going to be incredibly interested and be willing to, might be willing to say, hey, use my capability. And that is the principle of an ecosystem model. Identify the problem, identify the critical capabilities around which to orchestrate it, establish partnerships with them in service of delivering value. That's a win-win for everybody. And what we did in 3 months, while the bank was delivering 1,500 of these a week, we were delivering 1,500 a day. And then within a year, they had 300,000 customers. In 2 years, they had 3 million customers, and on. So this ecosystem-centric model, which again is around orchestrating capabilities from different partners to capture new sources of value, is the core to what I mean. And it's not just, look, this is not just a African or an outside the US thing. Look at Angie's List. What's Angie's List? It's a platform by which to orchestrate different capabilities from different people and service to helping you service your home more effectively. What is Uber? Uber's the same model. There are a pattern of these ecosystem-centric models that you can see, all designed around this principle of, I don't have to own it. What I need to do is figure out what are the capabilities and how do I orchestrate it from other people to create new sources of value. That's what I mean by business ecosystem.
So let's break down a couple of words that you used there, Ralph, and to understand a little bit more. We love the word orchestration because that is an entrepreneurial skill. Is somebody, an individual, doing that orchestration, or does it emerge in some fashion from that confluence of the needs of the telco and the needs of the consumer and the needs of the store and so on? Do you see somebody being the mastermind who orchestrates this, or is it the market that comes together?
Well, it's an interesting way to characterize it, I think. So there's a saying I use a lot, which is value seen is value captured. And what do I mean by that? I remember years ago, my wife and I, we bought a car. We bought a green car. And I remember when we first took it off the car lot, we bought a green Subaru. And I remember when we took it off the lot, all of a sudden, I saw green Subarus all over the place. Whereas previous to that, I didn't see them at all. And so it's like when you put on glasses, sunglasses are a different type of glasses with different tints to them. Different things are exposed. You see different things. And so it's not that these things aren't there. It's just that we don't see them. So that's what I mean by value seen is value captured. So someone has to see these opportunities that happen to exist. That's where the entrepreneur comes in. Now, from a market point of view, sure, these things exist. These points of friction exist. For Uber, they saw the absolute friction of lack of convenience. Let me go tackle that problem. For the entrepreneur in the bank I just gave, it was the no food until Friday, can't pay for it. Someone had to see that, but the market, you know, those friction points were still there. So the entrepreneur is the one who says, hey, I want to plant my flag around this problem, figure out how I'm going to solve it, and you go from there. So then the orchestration part of it is, all right, I have decided to tackle this point of friction because I see potentially a new source of value. How am I going to do that differently than what others have? And that's where the orchestration piece comes in.
And just to understand the other word that's really important to our listeners, that's value and value creation. So that's solving the problem in your model, right? The value is created if you solve the problem.
Yes. Yeah. You know, the way I think about that is there are things that you can do based on what you always do. And here's a problem that I see with that is, about 20% of capabilities or assets within any firm that drives the majority of economic value. However, things in the world change. And because things in the world change, those assets, those ways that you've been doing business aren't successful anymore. So we are often optimized for a world that no longer exists, which is why you see the topple rate, the title of the book, accelerating in every industry, the topple rate by which firms disappear or they fall from their competitive position and new ones are always appearing. Well, what's underlying that? The mechanics of what's underlying that is that the 20% of assets that drive the majority of economic value changes. And so if you can, you as the entrepreneur can say, hey, this is the friction I want to tackle. This is the flag I want to plant in a particular area. Then what are that 20% of critical capabilities that I need to make sure that I as entrepreneur orchestrate, own, and then I can frankly orchestrate all the rest.
So that idea of 20% of the assets being the ones that create value is particularly interesting to us. But before we get there, Ralph, I wanted to kind of go through a step by step. So if I'm a business owner, or I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a manager, I'm a strategist, I want to identify an ecosystem in which I can find this explosive growth that you talk about. That's super attractive. What's my methodology? How do I go about identifying the ecosystem opportunity?
Yeah, so I actually think we can pragmatically break this down into three steps. Number one is where do you want to plant your flag? What is that friction that you want to tackle, whether it's the Angie's List, whether it's the Uber, or whether it's the whatever else it happens to be, a new payment system, take Tesla. The essential friction point that Tesla wanted to tackle was what? It was better batteries. And then the vehicles are a mechanism around which to do that. So it's identifying where you want to plant your flag. What problem do you want to own? And then once you identify what is that problem, whether it's that banking that I talked about, right? It doesn't matter what it is, then it's an exercise of, well, what are the key capabilities necessary to do that? Now, what's key here is to not think about it from the point of view of any particular industry. And that's where and that's why I loved the experience that I was privileged to have of looking at Africa's fastest growing bank versus an entrepreneur. A bank is trained to think like a bank. The entrepreneur was geared to think of, I want to solve a problem. How do I do it differently? And so number one, what is that friction point that you want to tackle, or what flag do you want to plant? Number two, what are those key capabilities that you need in order to solve that problem, no matter where they happen to come from? And then once you've done that, for example, mobile exchange or new the long life batteries, whatever it happens to be, then it becomes pretty mechanical. And then it's just an issue of, okay, say I've identified 4 capabilities, 10 capabilities that are absolutely critical to drive value here. Then you ask the question, well, who does that? Who in the world provides those type of capabilities? And what industry does it happen to come from? So the exercise we went through, just to go back to the initial example of the banking one, of the micropayments one, mode of exchange. Well, who provides a mode of exchange? Well, you know, banks do, sure. But what else? Telco. Oh, okay, telco. So you can see how immediately you're breaking the traditional boundaries of how often we are trained to think within a domain or within a particular industry. And we said, well, back then with Muhammad, it was, all right, we need to go partner with telcos. That's where we need to focus. So again, the steps are, what's the friction you want to tackle, or the flag you want to plant? What are the critical capabilities necessary to do it? The critical few. Number three, who provides those type of capabilities? How well do they do it? And then go partner for them, or go get them.
Yeah, good. That's really clear. On the supply side, there's another interesting thought that you had in the book on the demand side, Ralph, which is you talk about an engagement model, having the entrepreneur build an engagement model on insights about where the customers spend their time, energy, and resources in the ecosystem.
Yeah. Yes.
So is that the friction? Is that finding the friction by understanding where they spend their time, energy, and resources?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And this is one that I can use an example. Let's pull it back to the States now. Is, you know, over and over and over again. But often, look, my experience, often when an organization, or when I used to do consulting with an organization, and people would say, well, how do we market to our customers differently? It was often, again, from the vantage point of what it is that I currently sell to my customers. So I am a, example, I am a apparel firm.
Mm-hmm.
I sell athletic equipment to people. What I want to do is I want to sell more shoes. I want to sell more sweatshirts, whatever else. And so what I do is I come up with really, really cool, sexy marketing campaigns and jingles and whatever else to sell more things. That's great. And I think that the majority, many experiences and people tend to focus it that way. How do I sell more of what I currently do to what it is that these people are saying about my shoe or about my shirt, my sweatshirts or adjacency? Oh, all right. So I'm not simply going to sell shoes. I'm going to let them design the shoes. I'm going to sell them other things that can wrap around the shoes. I'm going to send some adjacencies around that. From the point of view of what it is that I typically sell to my customers and what I've observed of them that they want. Here's the problem with that. Problem is, and this runs into what I call the Red Queen problem. And if you remember the Red Queen, Hunter, she's the character from Alice in Wonderland who runs faster and faster, but stays in the same place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the problem with that is I see an awful lot of organizations running the Red Queen race, which is how do I out-execute what everyone else is doing? The problem with that, if you're trying to out-execute people, maybe you can have differentiation for a little while, but ultimately that's going to go away. So many of the firms that I observe are looking at it of how can I sell more of what I currently deliver my products and some adjacencies? So to take another perspective of it, if, however, you say, what is it that forget about my shoes, my apparel. What is it about my customers in terms of where they spend their time and their money? What is it that they do independently of what I'm doing? And so for this particular apparel company, we found out that a number, they had their market segments, 18 different segments of folks. And we found that an awful lot of them spend a tremendous amount of their time. We'll just pick on one area. They were interested in music. Well, what the heck is the correlation between music and selling apparel? Well, we found that an awful lot of, there's an enormous number of people in the world who like to play music, like to listen to music, like to engage in music. So we said, well, wait a minute. What's the friction point that they are having in terms of their enjoyment or participation in music? And here's one quote that we heard. I'll never forget this from a young drummer in San Diego. And he said, look, what I would really like to do, honestly, I would really like to jam with some Ghanaian trumpet players. I'm going, what? But I would really like to explore different type of musics and be able to have an environment in which I could jam with people around the world or whatever it happens to be. That was the friction point. The friction point was, how do I find and match people with similar interests around music? This had nothing to do initially with selling shoes or selling apparel. Mm-hmm. But the problem was find and match. That was the essential of the find. It happened in this case to be applied to music, but it could be applied to other things as well. So what we did is we built a service layer on top. So imagine two rectangular boxes. The box down below is the core products that you happen to sell. And then there's a horizontal box on top, which are the services that you could offer that satisfies, that tackles the friction points of the customers you happen to have. So as opposed to creating more marketing, sexy marketing campaigns around buy more of my shoes, we solve the problem of how do you find and match other in the world of music. Now, what that did is not dissimilar to what AWS, so Amazon Web Services did, where on their bottom box was I sell my e-commerce products, and then they also had the AWS, the service, and as we all know that they feed each other. We built a mm-hmm. service where people could find and match each other. Now, what that did is it powered by this particular brand. Now, what that did is it drove an enormous amount of non-incremental revenue back to the firm, as well as creating a net new revenue stream for them as well, around finding music. But what was really interesting is the algorithms of finding and matching was something that can be leveraged over and over and over again, whether it was to sell more shoes, more apparel, or drive new revenue streams based on the data that they were collecting. So that's an example of don't just look at the particular problems your customers say you have with your product. look at the problems or the friction points they have and see is there any other service or any type of capabilities you can provide them to solve their problem. Because clearly, if we can take friction out of our customers' lives, they're going to be appreciative. They're going to be able to spend more time in what it is that they like to do. If we're associated with that, that's all goodness back to us. So that's an example. So I call it the Frank and Mary problem. The Frank and Mary problem is often we are so focused on our client, Frank, and we want to get Frank to buy more things. Well, Frank's always talking to Mary, his friend, who's not our customer. If we could figure out what's going on between Frank and Mary and what are the problems Frank and Mary have and where they're spending their time and money, and we focus on that issue, don't worry about what our core product happens to be. Solve that problem. Goodness will come from that.
Yeah, one of the phrases that you use in the book is to center the value delivery around what the customer wants to do, which is not the same, as you say, as selling them shoes, and then make that extraordinarily convenient for them.
Yes.
That's a great example.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4EPod. That's MISES.org/E4EPod, and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
So you talk then about value insights, Ralph, the value insights, the analytics at the ecosystem level that you've just described, to identify where there are economic opportunities from that value perspective. Is there a process for that? So I've identified my ecosystem. How do I develop those value insights?
Yeah, there is. There are a couple of things. One is, as we mentioned before, let's just talk about it from me, the entrepreneur point of view for a second. And then it's important to talk about the stakeholders, because there's difficulty. It's difficult for some people to wrap their head around, well, how the heck do I actually orchestrate an ecosystem? How can I get stakeholders engaged when, because they're different type of stakeholders and they come from different industries, they may have different motivations than do I. So how on earth are you going to mobilize that? So there are two parts to answer your question. Number one, the whole issue of the value insight is going to comes from, I believe, identifying these points of friction. So again, if you go back to the essential problem that Uber was solving, it was the issue of convenience. And then what they did, that there are capabilities around which to do that. I need a mapping capability. I need the ability to pay easily. And then I need partners around which to enable that to happen. So that's an example. Now, from your partner's point of view, here's where it gets really interesting. I'll use an example. And I like to use examples from outside of the U.S. because sometimes it takes you to a different part of the world, literally, where perhaps you don't have some of that prejudices that you may bring to the problem. So one of the ecosystems that we designed was around diabetes care. And the ecosystem that we established ranged from who you would expect, a large pharmaceutical company, a large technology company, but it also required getting involved with South African breweries, which is now, as you may know, is the world's largest brewery company. And the question was, well, how on earth are you going to get NGOs with hospital groups, with the pharmaceutical group, with the CEO of SAP involved in something like this? Because clearly they have different measures of success. Or even the first example I use, how are you going to get the CEO of the mobile company, Safaricom, to be involved here? Mm-hmm. Because again, his incentive is very, very different than anybody else. But that's where it gets interesting. So let's take the example of South Africa Brewery. The way we were able to get him involved was the following. I remember having a conversation with him, and he said, all right, diabetes, I get it. Sounds like a corporate social responsibility thing. Go talk to my corporate social responsibility person. I said, no. It's not going to drive scale that way. Let's look at it differently. Diabetes is a disease. A disease is going to impact the number of people who can actually work in your plant. It will impact productivity. As a result, your cost will go up, your productivity will go down, your margins will be hit, and your EPS will be hit over time as well. This is a problem that has direct traceability in terms of your bottom line. And as soon as you framed it that way, you said, ah, I get it. So one of the exercises, it's a very, very pragmatic exercise, is you can list out, and this is part of the tools that I indicate later in the book, list out the various stakeholders who you're engaged with. And then identify what is the fundamental value that they care about. Now, for South Africa Breweries and relating to its worker, it was productivity level. And then you say, well, what is the friction on that? Well, absenteeism. Well, how do we overcome that? In our particular case, since we were tackling diabetes, it was provide them care so they go back to work. So the idea, I call this a friction map. And the idea of a friction map is you identify the stakeholders, you identify the core, what fundamentally drives their value, what is the friction to overcome that? I'm sorry, what's the core friction that impedes that? And then what are the capabilities you need to overcome that? And if you could identify and orchestrate those capabilities to overcome it, you can very pragmatically draw in a lot of different types of stakeholders who care about something. That's one way to answer that question. There's another way. And I first ran across this, again, privilege of working with a very, very, very large portfolio of over $1 billion consisting of over 150 projects. And the question on the table was, where do I invest, or how do I make sure I can maximize the value, the return of this large portfolio across the products? And the challenge with that is the question, my argument to the CEO was the question was flawed. The question is not when I'm going to make the most money or when I'm going to be net cash positive. The question was, when am I going to realize different types of value based on the different stakeholders who I have? Because if you have a $1 billion portfolio and you have 150 different projects within it, which this company did, and they had well over 70 different partners involved in this large program, well, not all of those stakeholders cared about the same thing as the CEO of this large company did. Even internally, he had certain people on his executive team who didn't care about when he was going to be net cash positive. For example, there was a woman there, Hannah, who was the chief sustainability officer. What she cared about when she looked at this issue of value was carbon footprint. When you talk to the CFO, he did just care about net cash positive and the time with that. And other stakeholders cared about, the head of marketing didn't care about either of those. He cared about brand goodwill activities. So the point is, value itself can mean different things depending upon the stakeholder. So it's very, very important to understand. So the term I use in the book, and I use a lot, is currency. Currency is a unit of value that means something mm-hmm. different to different stakeholders. So in order to orchestrate successfully an ecosystem, the idea of understanding what are those currency, what are the different types of value that they care about? And then if you can make sure that you understand, oh, all right, so the currency for Hannah was about carbon footprint, the currency for Mark was about goodwill and so on. If you could actually create a nice little model that maps that, then you have something interesting. So what did that mean? Let me play out the example. So what we did then is we were able to take the different value, the different currency, but we created a currency map for the portfolio. And we said, all right, under these conditions, this is how you would reallocate the portfolio. And under this condition, here's how you would do it and so on. So to make it very, very tactical, Europe, again, this is a Fortune 50 company. So they had significant number of these projects in Europe as well. Europe is much further along in terms of their GAAP requirements in terms of climate footprint. And there, Europe is arguing, you know, it's years ahead of us. So we said, all right, if one of the key currencies that we cared about happens to be carbon footprint, then the portfolio and the investments would look like this. If we happen to focus on goodwill, the portfolio would look like this, and so on. So you get the idea. Depending upon the primary lens, value lens you're looking at, the portfolio or the decisions you would make would differ a little bit. And then what we were able to do is play out these different scenarios and say, here are the different options you've got. And then based on that, come up with a very effective mechanism by which to communicate. So that's another example of how to think through value in a way that pragmatically you can identify and orchestrate your ecosystem effectively.
Good. So let's return to this concept in your book, Ralph, which is very, very important, that you need to find the 20% of your assets that have true value capturing capability. And we're fans of Austrian economics here, and Austrian capital theory says something similar, that only very few of your assets probably generate customer revenue, are capable of generating customer revenue. The rest is support and overhead and other kinds of things. And you should focus on those unique assets for generating revenue and buy the rest from the market. You don't need to have them yourself. That sounds a little bit similar, but how do you identify the 20%? Tell us about the research that got you to that 20% number.
Yeah, well, so one, you're absolutely right. Those two are ridiculously complementary, right?
Good.
So one of the reasons now COVID COVID is a horrific event. It's also, however, an incredible wake-up call. And I'd love to get your perspective on this as well. The way I'm thinking about this, and I've had an awful lot of conversations with people around this as well, is over the next 6 to 12 months, it's all about how do we protect our workforce and our business. What are the few things we need in order to protect our business? Now, if you think about this from the 20% point of view, we are living in an extraordinary experiment where this whole issue of the 20% is what arguably everybody in the world who's in the business world has to think about on a day-to-day basis. What are the critical things around which I can do to protect my business and my workforce? All right, that's the next 6 to 12 months. But as we move into the new competitive normal, the next question is COVID, and I personally believe it is it a structural shift in terms of what constitutes the new 20%? And consequently, what do we need to start doing now to position ourselves to make sure that we have that stronger resilience in that new competitive normal? So this whole exercise of what is that new 20% is on the minds of everybody today, but based on different time horizons. So today, in terms of what people think that happens to be versus what it actually is going to be is such an interesting question right now.
Yeah. I think about the restaurant business a lot. If the friction is getting food on a plate in front of a customer, that's one way you can repurpose assets. You can get into delivery if you can't deliver in the restaurant. But it's also social and entertainment, and you've got to find out what are the capabilities that you need to provide that social entertainment factor if you can't do it in the restaurant room like you used to be able to.
Well, you know, that's why looking at restaurants and looking at the music industry to me right now is incredibly fascinating. I mean, I look at a couple of them, but I've been really intrigued by those two areas for, well, personal reasons. I like to eat, but also the music thing. I mean, it's so freaking stark in terms of what's happening as well. But I think that what you said is actually quite profound, because again, this goes straight to pull together some of the examples I used before. What are the friction points that I as consumer have around eating? And what else can I do? What other services can you, restaurateur, you, musician, offer to me that eliminate some of the friction points? And if you do that, then I will be attracted to you and I will support you on and on. So there is a fascinating article, I forget where it was, New York Times, New Yorker, someplace recently, about what Erica Badu is doing. Erica Badu she's an amazing, I believe, musician. And the interview with her was, I can't go out to perform. She even uses the word friction. And she said, what is it that what are services I can do to make people's lives better right now? And she's experimenting with this right now very much of how do you do outreach differently? How do you provide comfort and entertainment, not just through the music, but are there other channels that she can develop for? Are there other partnerships? Like she's talking about doing partnerships with certain type of restaurateurs around the country and so on. But there are a number of these experiments about how do you do that, not tackling just the friction of her as performer, but she's looking at it from the point of view of her Marys and her Franks and say, what else can we do as a group of people to tackle those problems? Which I find, I mean, one of the first times I've ever heard a musician, a true entrepreneur thinking around it from that point of view.
Right. So the 20% of the assets that are important are those that are reducing the friction and they're specific to you, right? They're just not market available assets.
Yeah. So there are, one of the things that I think is really, really key to take a look at what are the key KPIs that are driving your business. And again, and from my point of view, it very much is around tackling the friction points, making it really, really easy for your consumers, not the ones that they, as we talked about, the current products that I've got today, but the adjacent ones. And then looking at your 20% from that point of view. I cannot more strongly argue that that's absolutely critical, because otherwise you run into the classic Kodak thing. You're optimizing for a market that no longer exists. Markets are constantly shifting. What are those capabilities that we need to develop in as well in order to service them? Now, how you measure that in terms of profitability, whatever else, sure. But the capabilities in order to drive those economics, those things are shifting. Now, having said that, an insurance company, what is an insurance company? An insurance company is a business organized around managing a book of risk. That's all they are. So I'm not talking about insurance companies will go away, but the methods by which risks will be identified and priced will absolutely different. So the core asset of an insurance company is identifying and pricing risk. The mechanics, the mechanisms, the capabilities to do so will change dramatically. Insurance companies were caught off guard completely by COVID. The mechanism by which that they tend to price risk, are we're seeing that over and over again. The ability to dynamically price risk, for example, is a friction point that more and more insurance companies are recognizing, hey, we really don't have that capability effectively. So how do we do that? So you're going to see a dramatic shift in the insurance industry towards the issue of risk is still what my core business is, how I identify it, the nature of the risk, how I correlate different type of risk, the math I use to do it, that will change dramatically. So the form that their risk as core asset will shift dramatically. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. One last question about a phrase in your book, Ralph, which is selfish value. Mm. So I'm an economist. It sounded like Adam Smith saying, it's not from the benevolence of the butcher, brewer, the baker we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. And that was called self-interest. Does that have anything to do with what you're saying with selfish interest, or are you thinking something else?
So I'm thinking from the point. So let me step back before I answer that question directly, is adaptation. Because the whole issue of the selfish value is drawn from the Richard Dawkins issue of the selfish gene. And genes, as we all know, are adaptations to market environments, are to environments. And so it's precisely that adaptation to what? So innovation is, in my mind, is about how do we mobilize capabilities in service of new value? Value is what? As we talked about before, it's identifying new points of friction. Adaptation is simply modifying to change environments, which create friction to which we have to adapt. So that's how I think about it.
Good. Adaptation. I understand. Well, we're running out of time, Ralph. So let me thank you for this fascinating and highly educational but short spin through your book. The full title is Topple, The End of the Firm-Based Strategy and the Rise of New Models for Explosive Growth. I recommend it to everybody. It's available on Amazon. We'll link to it on our podcast page. Every week, Ralph, we like to provide a free downloadable knowledge graphic for our listeners. So I wondered whether I could adapt one of the graphics in your book if we give it full recognition.
Oh, sure.
Good. And we're trying to build a platform for entrepreneurs. We call it Economics for Business. And I'd love to include your process of identifying ecosystems and friction points and capabilities in the platform.
I'd be honored. Thank you.
Good. Aurel, thanks for visiting us at Economics for Entrepreneurs. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks. Have a good day.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.